The Gamma Quadrant, gentlemen. Millions of new worlds at our very doorstep. The potential for Ferengi business expansion is staggering.
And, best of all, no one there has ever heard the name Ferengi.
Our reputation will be absolutely stainless.
Our word can be our bond.
Until we decide to break it.
It'll be the good old days all over again.
Transfer complete.
Greetings, Humans. Welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, living his life by rule of acquisition 178.
And what is number 178?
Look it up, people. You'll find out. Yeah.
Very sly. Okay, we are here this week to talk about the evolution of the Ferengi.
Yeah, Cam, I think this has been a polarizing, you know, species on Star Trek.
Yeah.
But you know what? They've persisted. They've become one of the most iconic species out there. And I think we want to do is tackle why exactly that is. And whether maybe there's going to be room down the road in Star Trek Discovery or even the Kelvinverse to introduce them. I know it might be a little bit tricky with how they were kind of introduced in Star Trek The Next Generation as a brand new species. But they did kind of play around with that on Enterprise. So I think room for us to have some fun with that as well. But Cam, for you, what were your initial impressions of the Ferengi, or how did you think of them before you really got into Star Trek?
Okay, well, you got to remember, I watched Deep Space Nine before I really dove into TNG. I'd seen some TNG episodes here and there, but I had almost no memory of the Ferengi whatsoever from that series. So my first awareness of the Ferengi was seeing Quark in advertisements for Deep Space Nine. I didn't know who he was, but I liked the makeup. Like, I thought the makeup was really cool as a kid when I saw the trailers for Deep Space Nine. When I watched the show, I would say that I actually really liked the character right out of the bat. I had no issues against the Ferengi. I had avoided that period of time that all these TNG fans went through, just loathing these characters. But I will say that when I was going through Deep Space Nine, I often found it frustrating and that I'd be really wrapped up in the story of Deep Space Nine. And then I would hit a Ferengi episode. Like, those types of diversion episodes would often annoy me because it's like, I don't care about this episode. Get me back to, you know, the central drama that I'm really wrapped up in. And I will say, to be fair to the Ferengi, I felt the same way about Mirror Universe episodes my first time through DS9 as well. But yeah, the Ferengi.
So you're going through your second watch of Deep Space Nine now.
Completed it.
So yeah. Was it a little bit different?
It was very much so. Okay. Yeah, like I felt much differently the second time through, in that I was more willing to kind of give myself over to the energy of these Ferengi episodes and more interested in delving into how much effort was put into developing their society and giving it a certain amount of dramatic weight, as well as tackling it with sincerity, which is something I think that was missing in a lot of the Ferengi stories early on, and that they do feel kind of goofy.
Yeah.
And I do think, you know, Ira Stephen Baer, I don't know if he did for the Ferengi. He's often compared to what Ron Moore did to the Klingons. I don't know that he hit the heights of what Ron Moore did to the Klingons for people, but I think it was a noble attempt, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see how future generations of Star Trek storytellers build off what he created. But I don't feel the Ferengi, even at the end of Deep Space Nine, were there yet.
Okay. My only concern, though, about future iterations is that they might become characters of themselves.
Although, didn't they start that way?
Well, I know, but you know, they became into something far more interesting and far more layered.
Yeah.
So if they fall back into, you know, when we were watching The Killing Game and we had those holographic Klingons that Neelix and Janeway were chilling with.
Yeah.
And the depictions of these Klingons on Voyager just seemed more like characters of Klingons. They didn't really seem to have kind of the layers that we had become used to. I worry about the future of the Ferengi with regards to that. But my own introduction came with, you know, TNG. I think I was, you know, more familiar with watching them in like episodes like Rascals, you know, where they're just kind of, or Captain's Holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And this would have been in like reruns and stuff. And so they're more like kind of like comedic foils
right,
as opposed to like sinister villains, is what I think the original intention was.
Yeah, it was,
from the creators, and so when they ended up appearing on Deep Space Nine, honestly, like I wasn't super excited. You know, I thought they were kind of amusing, or at least I knew what they represented with regards to the world of Star Trek, which is kind of the antithesis of humanity. So you're not really supposed to cheer for them.
Right, yeah.
Which is like a great dramatic reason to introduce them to Deep Space Nine. But as an 8-year-old, I wasn't really thrilled to experience that. So it actually took me a long time to come around to the Ferengi. And we will get into episodes maybe where we started to come around. But I think we should also discuss, like, what do you think ultimately the creators were trying to do with their introduction, like early on, because they wanted to have this, you know, big out there sort of villain
that
would be as iconic as the Romulans or the Klingons, but they didn't want to keep repeating the same, you know, the Romulans are back, the Klingons are back, you know, they didn't want to do that again. So what ultimately do you think they were trying to do in concept that didn't quite come through in initial execution?
I think I can nail this down pretty easily, actually, is that, you know, yes, they said they wanted to follow up the Klingons and the Romulans because they didn't want to use Klingons as villains anymore, obviously. And so the Ferengi are born. I think the biggest problem is when we look at both the Klingons and the Romulans, you look at the episodes that are introduced in Star Trek, Errand of Mercy for the Klingons and Balance of Terror for the Romulans. Both those episodes nail down the exact soul of these alien species. Like, you understand who these characters are fundamentally and why they have a certain amount of dignity and deserve respect as adversaries to your crew. They did not succeed in that mission with the Ferengi. You watch The Last Outpost, they don't know what they're doing.
I would say both the writers and the Ferengi.
Yeah, neither one knows. But
didn't know what they're doing.
There's no, like, soulfulness to this alien race in this episode. They're played as just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And Armin Shimerman said they were told to just hop up and down like crazed gerbils. So, like, that is not the sign of a species that they're like, we need them to be, like, a worthy adversary for the Federation.
Well, they're there to represent the antithesis to 24th century humanity in which they're still consumed by capitalistic greed.
And we should say, this is 1987. This is, like, the 80s. This is all the big capitalist craze. You've got, like, Wall Street.
Yeah.
You know, greed is good. So it makes sense. The Ferengi make a lot of sense on paper as to why they were an idea that popped up at this time for Star Trek.
But the problem was is that if you are trying to depict something as the antithesis of your heroes, you're not giving them that dignity that you were talking about with regards to the Klingons or the Romulans. You're depicting them as utter buffoons. You understand what their motivation is. It's, you know, profit, profit, profit. But why should we be invested in what they're doing, especially if they're just depicted as complete, like, numbskulls?
Right. You know, when you look at the original Klingons and Romulans, they have philosophical discussions with our heroes. You do not get that in these early episodes. It just seems like these Ferengi just sputtering stuff about profit, while Picard, who, you know, boy, if you want to pit a villain that seems a little bit pea-brained in these early episodes against a captain, Picard is the wrong one to do it to, because he just seems so bright and intelligent and thoughtful that it's just really punching downwards for him going against these Ferengi.
It's like the Ferengi are bringing a butter knife to a gunfight.
Exactly.
It's kinda like, is this really all that compelling?
Yeah.
So, Kim, why don't we go through some of the significant Ferengi episodes and try to nail down what the big moments were for them? Because I think TNG, like, it eventually came across like a turning point for them, and they realized, this is what we can do to make them work. And then when you get around to Deep Space Nine, they become even layered, and there's like a bit of a mythology that starts to develop that is kind of fascinating to see, as I think they're kind of making it up as they go along. But you're like, wow, I could imagine this for the Klingons, but I never imagined this necessarily for the Ferengis.
It became very clear to me doing research for this episode that perhaps Ferengi episodes are the toughest high wire act to walk for a Star Trek writer. Because they're overtly more comedic once they kind of nail down how to use the Ferengi properly. And that is really tough, especially when it's Star Trek, which is not great at comedy. And so you want to balance the comedy of the Ferengi with some sort of sincere message to the story. I think that's a lot of the best Ferengi episodes. But boy, is that tough to do. And you see them really struggle a lot.
Yeah. Well, let's start with The Last Outpost.
Yeah, one of the greats.
Well, it is fascinating in that they were introduced, as you said, as gerbils jumping up and down on rocks. We have the very early, you know, kind of culture set out there with regards to their misogyny, though, because they're just shocked that women are walking around in clothes. So again, like, how can you even get behind a species like that at this point?
Yes.
They are designed from the get-go for you to absolutely hate them and not relate to them at all. They're trying to say, look how awful these, you know, species are. So like already, you know, their back is kind of against the wall with the audience having any sort of, I guess, just any sort of interest in where they are as a species.
Right. And not only that, like that whole, you know, the whole misogynistic element of Ferengis is, yeah, it's impossible to defend. But, you know, you would expect, if you want to write your main adversary for the show, you would want to give them a philosophical way to explain why they feel this way. The show doesn't do that. It's just like, this is bad. Why do you do this?
And I'll go back to like a quote that I or Stephen Bear had later on. But he said, hey, you know what the joke is the Ferengis are 20th century humans. Which you can say that's they're the most human characters that represent us right now. But there are so many elements that are just utterly toxic that you think that, okay, even us right now, not as bad as the Ferengi. And I think the misogyny is far and foremost among those. We'll get into that even deeper when we get into the Deep Space Nine stuff. But it is, okay, so we're talking about kind of the Ferengi culture. It was odd that they, in the last outpost, are established as a species where visual communication is off limits.
Sure.
And then they're calling humans ugly right out the gate, which is interesting. And it also contradicts how Ferengis actually seem to be attracted to women that look human or humanoid. You know,
right, which we do see through the course of Star Trek, really.
Yeah. So the other thing that's I think we need to touch upon is just kind of the aesthetic look of the Ferengis here. We'll get to their lobes and all that, but I want to ask you about that, say, the electro whips that were clearly like lightsaber knockoffs, but done really poorly.
But limp.
I mean, at least they're trying. Okay, I'm going to give props to the writers for at least trying to think of something outside the box, do something a little different. Do you think they're just stymied by, I guess, 1980s TV budgets and resources at that point?
Well, definitely. I don't hate the laser whips, though.
Okay.
I think energy whips is what they're referred to as. But I don't hate the idea of giving these characters distinctive weapons. I think that's interesting.
You don't hate the idea. What would you have done differently maybe with the execution to make them appear a little bit more intimidating?
Well,
it's tough because I think you are doing something that it's high concept, but you have to be aware of the fact that you're on a little dinky show that doesn't really have the budget.
Exactly.
It does not have a Star Trek Discovery budget at this point.
And you would see later down the road, TNG would figure out how to direct episodes really well with a low budget, relatively low. You can tell in season one, they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Like, The Last Outpost in particular feels so off model across the board. So I don't expect them to nail down a really interesting visual grammar for the Ferengi when everything else is insane.
Speaking of grammar, what about Geordi yelling, woo-wee?
One of my favorite moments. I actually burst out laughing
when that happened. I actually pushed rewind and watched it again. I was just floored by these early episodes of TNG.
It's just like the ongoing story of Data and the finger cuffs. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. It was so weird.
Yeah. But with regards to the Ferengi, we also have a bit of a different outfit. They're kind of compared to like Yankee traders.
Multiple times. And the funny thing was, when they said that, I initially was like, I thought they'd said traitors as in, you know, traitor as in Benedict Arnold, like turning on someone, traitors. And then I'm like, what is a Yankee traitor? I'm like, what does that even mean? And then I realized, oh no, they mean traitors. And then I was still like, what does that mean?
Yeah, like on the high seas, I suppose.
I feel they
didn't want to use the word pirate.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I feel like if you're going to throw a term out there, it should be easily identifiable, because a lot of young kids watch Star Trek. And if I'm sitting there at the sad age of 37 being like, what specifically does that mean?
I have to admit, even as somebody who grew up in the United States, it's not like Yankee traitor is something that was in my vocabulary, even mixed in with all the Americans. So I don't know. But they are, you know, compared with Yankee traders, and they're walking around in kind of like caveman furs. They look like Fred Flintstone outfits that you would be walking around in, except they've got like undergarments below, and they got furry boots too. So they got this kind of caveman look, which they eventually do away with. But I mean, if they're supposed to be kind of this capitalist society where that values material possessions, are these not the stupidest looking things to be like prancing around in the galaxy about with?
Yes. They reminded me a lot, their outfits reminded me a lot of the Enterprise Klingon uniforms where they put a lot more fur and stuff like that, which makes sense for, like, a warrior society.
I buy that, yeah.
But, yeah, no, in a capitalist society, it doesn't make any sense. I think it makes a lot more sense when, you know, they have a lot of the color and fabrics of Deep Space Nine. I just found, though, like, it seemed to me this whole episode is so stuck in the world of TOS.
Yeah.
Like, the way the Ferengi are dressed and everything feels like TOS aliens. The whole deal with this planet and this guardian that comes down feels like a TOS episode. I was calling this episode, I made a joking note, called it the Quarkamite Maneuver.
Okay.
Because the whole intro is like this, like, ship of, like, what does it do? What could it do? You know, it feels very Corbomite Maneuver. And so it just feels like they're still struggling to define this show away from TOS. And the Ferengi fall smack dab into that really weird gray zone between TOS and TNG.
Well, it's funny that you bring up TOS, because I was thinking the whole time, like, early season one just seems like all these successful or at least skillful 1960s writers were just suddenly transplanted into the 1980s. It's like a time warp sort of, like, thing.
Yeah.
And they just don't know what to do. They don't know how society is, because it wasn't as if, like, TV was awful. There were still, like, good shows being produced, but, like, they just didn't know what would make for a good TNG show at that time. And proof's in the pudding. I mean, you give it to Michael Piller by season three, and he's kind of figured out what actually works for kind of modern sci-fi show.
Because we should say the episode The Last Outpost is written by Roddenberry and Herbert Wright. And, you know, you can just tell that this is the era where TNG is, boy, is it rocky behind the scenes. And these guys just didn't really know really what they were doing. But, I mean, I guess you can give them some credit for at least establishing, like, what this alien race kind of is. You know, the early stages are there.
Okay, and I think the most important thing is just the look of their lobes and their heads, you know? Like, it is so distinctive. You can tell that they put a lot of thought into what these aliens would look like. Do you think that's one of the reasons why they just did not want to give up on the Ferengi at that point, in that they were so distinct looking, and I think, like, fans could recognize them. Even, like, non-fans, like, out in the street, you could probably recognize what a Ferengi looks like at this point.
They do feel like a really instantly iconic visual design.
Yeah.
I think there's a reason when they were putting out, like, those Galoob action figures, there's a Ferengi in there. It's like, the Ferengi are easily marketable from a visual standpoint because you instantly know what one is.
Yeah.
But, weird. Weird episode. You can totally understand why it didn't click. It was interesting that they pretty much were ready to give up on them after this episode, because so great was the disapproval to their first appearance.
Yeah. Well,
but I just had a question for you, because when you see this point, they are trying to establish them as Klingon, sort of Romulan heavies. But I was really, like, racking my brain trying to come up with another case where, like, a franchise or whatever introduced, like, diminutive adversaries, and it worked on a serious dramatic level. Like, usually that tends to be more comedic, which is what the Ferengi ultimately go. I could not think of a good example of sort of a diminutive adversary who was scary or threatening or felt like an imposing dramatic force.
No, and I think, like, if you are specifically, you know, conceptualizing something as, you know, like an adversary's diminutive,
mm-hmm.
there has to be a reason why for
yes.
that, and I'm trying to figure out what the intentions were with the writers. There have been some suggestions, even in Trek Academic Thought, that, like, they were supposed to be, like, offensive characters of Jewish people.
To be honest, that was one of my early takes on the Ferengi.
Yeah, and
I was this is kind of uncomfortable. And yeah, knowing the kind of the environment from which Spurn them, you know, that really awkward 80s period where Roddenberry's still trying to come up with ideas. It's kind of like when George Lucas created a couple alien species in the prequels.
On the Trade Federation?
Trade Federation, yeah. Watto, obviously Jar Jar Binks. But, like, he seemed completely baffled as to why people were offended. And part of me wondered if the Ferengi were kind of along those same lines initially.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure.
Yeah, but it's also, like, why, if they're meant to be this sinister adversary,
mm-hmm.
why are you making them diminutive off the bat?
Yes.
And then giving them, like, stage directions like jump on a rock.
Yeah.
You know, is weird. And also, what did you think about their fighting skills? Their fighting skills seem to be like jump on people's backs and like kick them like you're riding a pony.
Yeah. Like, I feel like if you're going to have these diminutive adversaries, they have to be so smart that they are, like, impossible to outsmart. Like, that's the problem. Like, that's the big struggle for Picard, is like, the Ferengi are smarter than us, and we have to try to conquer this problem somehow. where I was like, that's not really the case, especially here.
Okay. So let's go over to their next appearance here. This is the battle, in which, you know, we're still got them using jazz hands a lot for some reason. I don't exactly know why. But
that's the scariest thing of all. It's a villain doing jazz hands.
But it's essentially the episode in which Damon Bach comes to get revenge for his son's death because Picard, you know, destroyed his son's ship at the Battle of Maxia.
Yeah.
So essentially what we do find out, that I think this is actually critical, and I wish we had a similar moment in their first appearance, but like Damon Bach's first officer relieves Bach of duty because he's engaging in revenge.
Which is not profitable.
It's not profitable. So at least he has kind of this code that he lives by, and it's somewhat of an honor code, though.
Yes.
I think it gives him a bit of a lair. Yeah.
I think this character's name was like Kazago or Kazago.
Kazago, yeah.
And I actually really liked the scene where he's talking to Riker and saying, like, look, we've relieved him of duty. This was not profitable. But there is a certain amount of, like, a bit of an honorable exchange between him and Riker. They don't have the same philosophical underpinnings, but these two characters can recognize their responsibilities as first officers. And I'm like, that is how you do it. Like, that's how to nail down these alien species. And that, yeah, their philosophies are completely different than yours, but you can understand, like, a certain amount of dignity or honor code among them. Like, the problem is they gave them all this kind of grotesque caricature stuff early on with, like, you know, the misogyny and all that sort of stuff. But it's moments like this in the battle that I think work.
Would it have been better if Last Outpost just never existed? If this was the introduction to the Ferengi, do you think that they would prove to be a less problematic species going forward?
I think so. I mean, do you feel like there's anything in the Last Outpost that's vital?
They like to lick comm badges.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it sets up things, but you could have easily set that up in the battle.
Yeah, there's nothing to me that was vital in the Last Outpost.
No.
Unless it's Data's finger lock.
Well, that's incredibly vital.
Yeah, okay. the next time we see them, though, this is where they're starting to change a bit. This is in peak performance, which, of course, is the War Games.
Near the end of Season 2, because they were temporarily retired after the battle.
Yeah.
They were like, these characters are not working, let's just put them aside. Even though I think Damon Bach was an interesting idea.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And it's not the last appearance Damon Bach has on
They
the
waited
show.
A long time, Tyler.
Yeah, there's so many people waiting on the follow-up to that.
And they even changed actors.
But we do have them in peak performance here. And one thing that I think is notable, look, I think it could have been any species thrown into this here. Like, we don't really learn much about their culture. They do get new uniforms, though. I think the new uniforms actually signal a change in how they want them depicted.
Right.
They're more like suits that they're wearing, not like these Fred Flintstone outfits. And I think they're starting to refine the Ferengi.
Yeah, this was an attempt to fix them, apparently, behind the scenes.
So it starts to work. You know, I don't think they're nearly as problematic. We do get a return of Armin Shimmerman once again, but he's playing a different character, which is... They really were cheap on, like, paying out royalties to... writers.
I mean,
I don't get it.
Was there a real shortage of short actors in Hollywood at this point?
He was on the view screen. It could have been anybody.
Yeah.
You know, I think maybe what happened, though, is they like Armin Shimmerman. You can tell, like, a lot of these actors that end up as regulars, they've actually been going doing, like, auditions for, say, the casting director, Junie Lowry, for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
They were giving Armin Shimmerman Loxana Troy's magical box with the face on it.
Yeah,
like, he was doing that sort of stuff.
That's true.
So
yeah.
I can understand why they keep bringing him back for this. But as far as Ferengi mythology goes, we don't get too much out of it, but we do start to see a bit of a change. And I think this is very, very important.
It would have been interesting, though, because I don't think it would have been good, but Roddenberry had written a two-part episode, Ferengi-centric episode, called Ferengi's Gold for Season 2 that just never aired, but it would have dealt with similar things as Voyager tackled later down the road with these Ferengis using their technology to come across as gods. I would have just been curious to read what the real breakdown is, because there's not a lot of details out there, but just to see if that was an attempt to try and change the track a bit, because if you're doing a two-parter, that's a lot of Ferengi.
Yeah, and I don't think they would have been deserving of a two-parter at that time. I think I think the concept in which the Ferengi don't really care for the Prime Directive is interesting, because actually, you know what, that was interesting in the Last Outpost, in which Riker said, yes, we do withhold technology from species that are less developed,
right? Yeah.
You know, and the Ferengi were like, see, they're awful, awful, you know, species. So that's kind of an interesting difference that they had to juxtapose the humans and the Ferengi, but beyond that, you know. I'm intrigued by this idea of the Ferengis not living by a similar sort of prime directive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it would have been worth a two-parter, personally.
No.
Yeah. But I think the next episode that they appear in is one of the most important Ferengi episodes, period, in TNG, which is The Price. Of course, that one surrounds the Barzan wormhole.
Yeah.
Ferengis went in on the deal, and it's actually one of the, like, legit funny scenes in Star Trek where they show up, and they keep saying, "Where are the chairs? Can you get your Klingon servant to go get the chairs?"
Right, yeah, yeah.
"Oh, he's not your servant? So who's going to get the chairs?" And, like, they just right. would not stop talking about the chairs. It was like, I don't know, like a Seinfeld, like, excerpt or something like that. I got a big kick out of this scene. Like, it literally made me laugh, but it's very early on in the episode.
Yeah.
I think the writer's like, oh, they should be comedic foils here. Like, this is what they're really meant to be. Like, people don't really take them seriously as an adversary. Let's just play with it. Let's have fun with these guys.
Well, and I think it's best to play them as quirky and, you know...
Did you say quirky?
I know. As soon as I said that, I was like, oh, there's an easy pun there. But, I mean, I like the idea of, like, making them very idiosyncratic, but also standing outside of your daily business with the Federation and whatever, you know, kind of more dignified or whatever you want to say, alien species is, because they get to come in as these sort of wild cards who have their own, you know, ambitions and goals that they're trying to meet that do not meet what generally the central drama of the episode is. So they really are yeah. fun in that regard. And I think The Price, I don't really like this episode, but I think that they are actually really fun in it. It does feel like, you know, the writers are going, okay, this is the best way to use them.
I just remembered why I made a Seinfeld reference, because, of course, the actor who played Lloyd Braun in right. Seinfeld was in this one.
He's and, a really, really, really creepy romantic interest for Troy.
And for Elaine Bennis.
Isn't there, like, a long foot massage scene in this episode? I think there was.
Okay. No, I think you were just very nice and started, like, giving me one while we watched it.
That's possible.
Yeah. Look, we can't touch upon every single Ferengi episode in the universe, but I think what we start to get with episodes like Captain's Holiday, Menage a Troy, and The Perfect Mate, yeah. Rascals as well, is we get them involved in more kind of capers. They yeah. are kind of like adversaries.
And they're unpredictable to a certain yeah, degree, which I think works really well.
It's a good element to add in, because you know you can't... And I do want to address this issue, but you know you can't trust the Ferengi,
mm-hmm.
and their reputation starts to get around with regards to both fans as well as Starfleet members, where people are told you can't trust Ferengi, in which we're living in an ideal universe in which prejudice
yeah.
should be eliminated. And I want to get into this later on, Cam, but it is fascinating to me that it's okay to be racist or xenophobic towards Ferengi.
Right.
It's not necessarily okay to do that with other species, and Star Trek is very guilty about people being very prejudiced towards the Ferengi, and it's okay.
Right,
there's nothing wrong with that, and to me that irks me a lot with regards to Star Trek and how the Ferengi are depicted here.
I wonder how much of that is just tied to the fact that what they stand for, which is really, really, you know, gross capitalism, is something that humanity has grown past and looks so down upon that it's tough to look at them as anything other than in a negative light?
Do you think that, you know, maybe humans got a pass because we talk about misogyny, mm-hmm. and I think, look, how do you really reconcile that rampant misogyny that is just poisonous and toxic? You know, the point where women are expected to chew food for men.
Right.
They're not supposed to wear clothing. You know, I can't really blame, you know, 24th century humans for, you know, looking down upon them so much. You know?
It's actually kind of amazing that Star Trek didn't try and write itself out of that whole
yeah.
background with those characters.
Okay, let's say Ferengi never existed on TNG or Deep Space Nine. Do you
yeah.
think if they were to be introduced on, say, Star Trek Discovery, that element of their culture would have ever been part of them?
Not a chance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I do wonder if we hypothetically get any Ferengis in... You know, Star Trek Discovery, what they are going to do to address this. But we can talk yeah. about that later on.
We should say about Menage a Troy.
Yeah.
It does kind of set up the whole Umox thing, too, which becomes a big part of these characters going forward as well. And kind of a problematic one.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. but, so, I don't know, any TNG episodes that you think are kind of important to touch upon as vital turning points before we get into Deep Space Nine. I've kind of covered my thoughts about TNG.
I don't think there's a lot in furthering the evolution of the Ferengi, but I do think just the episode Bloodlines in Season 7, which pays off the Damon Bok thing.
Which we've all been waiting for.
The episode, whatever, is disposable. But more in the sense of, like, I like that they created a Ferengi character. Throughout the series, most of these Ferengi are kind of interchangeable, whereas Damon Bok becomes a legitimate character who's carried across multiple episodes and has a persona. I like that this one had his own objectives and his own aims, and that the show acknowledged him as standing maybe out from the rest of the Ferengi we saw pop up.
Yeah. Let's jump into Deep Space Nine. I think maybe one of the most important episodes here, in which we really get into Ferengi mythology, though, is the Negus.
Yeah.
And this, of course, is the introduction of one Grand Negus Sek. And I think this is intriguing in that they say, hey, look, our reputation is horrible here in the Alpha Quadrant. We can't really expand business that much more. Let's get into the Gamma Quadrant and see what we can do over there. That's an interesting plot element, but it's really all about, like, kind of, I guess, the introduction of Ferengi culture as we've never really seen it before. We really get into the nitty-gritty, and I find it interesting. I think this episode is...
it's rough.
It's a little rough,
yeah.
You know, but I think I can appreciate more for what it does in planting seeds for where we do go along with the Ferengi. With regards to... Let's get into it. Like, Wallace Shawn. Like,
right.
Do you think there really could have been any other Grand Negus Sek? Like, who else would you have really wanted playing a character like this? I just think he encapsulates everything about the Ferengi that you really need to know.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree. I think he's a lot of fun. It was interesting to me, Armin Shimerman's advice to him was, don't go over the top.
Okay.
I don't know that I agree that Wallace Shawn didn't go over the top.
Yeah. Well, he was saying that, you know what? Like, he's never felt freer as an actor. He just gets underneath all that makeup, and he... felt as if he could just do anything, and he really loved going on to Deep Space Nine. He said, yeah, it was like 3 hours of makeup, but I absolutely adored every experience that I had. And this guy wasn't like he was just on like a one-off character. I think he's in like 8 episodes altogether.
Yeah,
so.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently he could only about do one per year because the makeup was so awful that he was like, had to psych himself up for a year.
Yeah, fair enough.
I believe that.
You're in that for like, what, 8 days?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, yeah, I don't blame you, sir.
But I mentioned Armin Shimerman giving him advice, and we should note, like, Armin Shimerman was kind of lured back to Deep Space Nine to play Quark with the idea that he wanted to correct the mistakes of the past on TNG, where he played Ferengi as very just one-dimensional kind of goons. And he really wanted to give some dignity to the species. And so I think it's interesting that he is giving advice to Wallace Shawn as to how to do this, because obviously he knows as well that these aren't working. And I think that Zek is really interesting that he's definitely a polarizing character. I can totally see people who can't stand him.
Yeah.
He's definitely... unique as a one of the characters among, you know, the many of Star Trek, but
he's definitely one of them. Okay, for somebody who is only in 8 episodes, who do you think is more iconic, him or Vedic Barayal?
Well, definitely Zek. Yeah.
Okay, they're both in 8 episodes, so it is kind of like I think fans, like not necessarily people down on the street, but I think fans just instantly recognize Zek,
right? And I like that he is doing in many ways what Robert O'Reilly did for Gowron, in that's a weird performance as the leader of the Klingons. Like, Robert O'Reilly is definitely going kind of bananas with, you know, the wide eyes and all that sort of stuff. But Zek is going the same route. Like, he does feel like an instantly iconic alien leader. Like, you are not going to forget Zek after he pops up on the Negus. And he does very much represent everything that we, at this point in time, realize the Ferengi are about in ways that are... they feel interesting in a way that they haven't leading up to Deep Space Nine, but also you can understand how his influence is guiding them. Like, he feels very much like a very powerful character.
One last thought on the Negus before, you know, why don't we talk about Quark after this? Because I think it's actually kind of important that we, you know, dive into this guy, and we'll continue to do it as we go through other episodes. But the one thing that I had trouble with was Rom plotting to kill Quark.
Yeah.
Rom has one of the biggest character arcs on Deep Space Nine, and I think it's also very much representative of how Ferengi culture also changes, you know, where Rom, A, is a father, you know, and we're supposed to appreciate his relationship with his son. It's not quite, you know, the Jake and Ben relationship that we come to appreciate. And ultimately, Rom is given a free pass because Quark says, well, you're just trying to get profit. I'm finally, you know, proud of you, brother.
Yeah.
How do you go from, like, kind of a redemptive arc for, like, this guy who is like an attempted murderer to somebody who's marrying like one of the most benevolent characters on the series to somebody who eventually leads this species into reformation.
Well, I feel like the Negus, I mean, this is first season DS9, let's remember, and you know, first season DS9 is a little rocky. I don't think they've found the emotional truth in the Ferengi yet. And so it's still played a little broad where, oh, you tried to kill me? Well, don't do that again. It's just those sorts of results. Whereas I think they would nail down in the coming seasons the emotional truth of what a Ferengi is and how the Quark and Rom relationship works.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, when you throw in some of the other characters as well, like Nog.
So before we go into further episodes, let's talk a little bit about Quark and like ultimately what he offers to Star Trek, you know, as a Ferengi, you know, regular character. I find it interesting that, like I said earlier, I initially was kind of put off by having to see a Ferengi every single week on Star Trek, where it's like, the other issue, though, is how come Quark isn't in a jail cell yet?
Yeah.
It is confusing, but I have to say, I kind of can forget all about that, because, like, Armin Shimerman really is the Ferengi at this point. Yeah. Like, that is the man who says, okay, you know what, I can bring this element of humanity to something, or like a character that could otherwise just be just completely odious.
I think the reason Quark works so well for me on DS9 is that, you know, the thing about the Ferengi is they're very crafty and they're very smart and they can be tricky when they have to be. And I think when you look at the Deep Space Nine world, you know, that station and the situation they're involved in with the Bajorans and the Cardassians and all the danger associated with that, it takes someone like a Quark, who's very tricky and crafty when he has to be, to survive that sort of situation and continue. He is like the Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca character. And so, like, he's not going to get by if he's someone like a Vedic Brow, as you referenced, who's just very, you know, laid back and placid. Like,
We saw his fate in the Mirror Universe.
Yeah.
Quark dies early on.
That's right.
Spoiler alert.
Like, for Quark to continue through his existence on the station, he has to employ all the sort of characteristics, the negative characteristics we've seen on TNG, really, for the Ferengi. But we've got to see him using those to continue. And I like that the show finds a way to ground those in a way that is, if not honorable to humanize, like, they make sense within what the character would do and why other people don't judge him as harshly for it.
I'd have to say, early on, I thought Quark was kind of one note. And I don't think it was until, you know, I really did grow to like the character in later seasons, but it wasn't until I went back and rewatched earlier episodes that I realized, no, he wasn't nearly as one note as I had just assumed. And I'd like to think that he is kind of representative of DS Space Nine as a series overall, because you said, yes, he's got to be this way if he really wants to survive. But I think he's the ultimate kind of like shade of gray on a series like this, where it's like, okay, there's humanity, which has a great life on planet Earth. What happens if you're beyond the borders of the Federation? You know, like, people like him can succeed and persist. So I don't know. Like, I think just Shimmerman's performance just brings so much. We also know that Max Grodinchek was up for the role.
Yeah.
And I think Max Grodinchek was great as Rom. I don't know if we would have necessarily had the same gravitas brought to a character like Quark if it was Max Grodinchek playing that role.
I agree 100%, yeah.
Yeah.
And we should note, actually, sorry, just with that episode, the Negus, it does introduce the rules of acquisition, which I think is really important to informing this species. It's like, finally, after how many episodes, they nail down like a philosophical idea drives the Ferengi. Like, that's the sort of thing they should have come up with, if not in their first appearance, pretty quickly.
You know, but, you know, I like how, you know, the writers were inspired by then.
Yeah.
Like, and it just kind of makes sense that, yeah, that's essentially their constitution. That's their Bible, you know, to a certain degree. I think the next, like, really important episode here, and Cam, interrupt me if maybe I'm missing one in between, but I think Rules of Acquisition, which follows, you know, our discussion about the Rules of Acquisition. But we're introduced to Pell, who, of course, is the female Ferengi in disguise. She wants to go ahead and make profit. Why can't a woman make profit? I'm just as smart as any other man. And I think this is a very important episode with regards to addressing the rampant misogyny within Ferengi culture.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. For me, it's something I took note of in that Quark is saying, like, I want my women naked and submissive. Do you think that's really true?
No.
Not at all. I don't.
Because you look at the women Quark is drawn towards.
Yeah, exactly.
He does not like the submissive types, whether for friendships or for romantic partners.
So is it all just because he has to say that because he wants to fit into Ferengi society? Or maybe I'm getting into my thesis a little too early here. Or do you think it's just his exposure to the Federation that really starts to change his attitudes? Because prior to that, Quark was a guy who was around the Cardassians. Do you think the Cardassians are really going to be, you know, the pinnacles of, you know, humanity? Oh, obviously, I mean, they're Cardassians, but like of benevolence, of, you know, just compassion? No.
Yeah. He's a very interesting character in that you can have so many discussions on Quark as to, like, where is he coming from? Because to me, I often wondered if he's like someone who, like, is very stubborn about following tradition, but it's like his brain doesn't allow him to do that. Like, he's such an outside-the-box kind of rebellious thinker that he's constantly drawn and pulled in directions away from what tradition has dictated to him. He's almost like a character who's just been born and raised in the society, but his brain doesn't allow him to think like the rest of the people in his society. There's always that lure just outside of that.
And you bring that up, and so the question I have, and it's always been kind of unclear to me, is how successful is Quark as a businessman?
I don't think he's very successful.
No, because, I mean, look, lots of very successful, like, business owners. He runs a bar, but he's got all these side deals going on, but if he was really successful, I mean, he wants that moon, the same kind of setup that his cousin Gela has, right? Yeah. He doesn't have that. I wonder if we hear him, if he's really just more talk than he is, and I wonder if it's that, I don't know, humanity rubbing off on him to a certain degree, and we can get into that in a very important episode later on.
Yeah.
But I never got the sense that Quark was nearly as successful as we maybe were thought he was supposed to be.
Do you think it's just that he can't direct his fixations and what he's willing to put effort into? Because we see so often, he's the guy who knows everything that's going on the station. He'll hack into systems. He'll cause all sorts of problems. But these are not like schemes that are going to generate a lot of profit.
Yeah.
Like, he's not someone who's just investing.
It's kind of like chump change.
Yes.
Yeah,
and a lot of it is more like he's a rebel who's just driven towards like kind of causing trouble.
He must just have like a really bad portfolio.
He must.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
one other thing to really mention about Rules of Acquisition, though, is this is the first time we see Tongo being played, which I think is somewhat interesting. And as well as it establishes something that I think is actually really important in redeeming the Ferengi to the eyes of the viewers. Now, I know they've talked in the past about how the Ferengi episodes were actually not popular with passionate Star Trek fans, but they were really popular with, you know, the mythical people of the street.
Sure.
The people who are just kind of your casual viewers. But I think if there's a relationship built up, you know, it's already kind of started, but this episode really solidifies it, is this friendship with Dax. Dax is this character that is so beloved by people and such a fun character that to see her saying, "Ferengis are fun, like, what is wrong with you guys?" and socializing with Quark, I think that does a lot for kind of rehabilitating the image of Ferengi. As, you know, there's something, there's a note actually in the Bible for Deep Space Nine when they're sitting down to write, you know, the first season and what have you. It says, "The Ferengi race has been a part of TNG since the very beginning. They are ugly, sexist, greedy little aliens who are interested in only profit and getting their hands on anything of yours they happen to fancy." That's not the most positive way to describe this alien race for their series.
And you get to watch them week after week.
Yes, exactly. But I think the character of Dax does a lot to overturn this a bit and change them in the eyes of the audience, because Dax is a character I think people want to like and hang out with.
So
I think that does a lot.
If she's into the Ferengi, then it means that there must be something about them that's worth exploring.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Aside from that, like, there is a note I wanted to touch on, which is the episode of the Jem'Hadar.
Okay.
Where you really get the first instance of Quark opposing Sisko, essentially, over decision and saying, you know, the Federation doesn't really have it right. We would avoid these sorts of problems. This is not like a great moment in the history of Ferengi, but it does throw down the breadcrumbs for what you will see later down the series, where Quark is having these philosophical moments, really underscoring why the Federation's situation on Deep Space Nine is not what the Ferengi would agree with.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that does a great deal to give this alien species a lot of dignity.
But it kind of makes sense. I mean, Look, I don't think the Ferengi necessarily would have been planning on like a war with the Dominion. Yeah. They wanted to trade Tulaberry wine with them. So
yeah. But yeah, we then jump into season three, and there's a couple in there like House of Quark and Profit Motive. Profit Motive's at least kind of notable just for the fact that like Zek becomes a philanthropist and just giving away his money. So that's kind of fun. But we get into family business. This is the really big one.
Yeah, and I think this is where we get the introduction of Ishka, a.k.a. Moogie.
Moogie.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because, like, Quark is, like, saying, females, they don't belong in business. Why? Well, because it's wrong. Well, why is it wrong? And he finally says, well, it's because it's the law.
Yeah.
So it's like, you can't, he can't even make a good argument for why women can't be in business. And essentially, it's enshrined into the law. So it is that inherent misogyny that we see so pervasive throughout this species. I like the fact that in TNG, they can kind of brush off the misogyny, play it for laughs. Whereas Deep Space Nine, between this episode and between Rules of Acquisition, they're tackling it head on. They're like, guys, this is the stupidest thing ever. Like, you can't even make a good argument to keep women out of business, though. And I like the fact that we start to establish that, you know, like, Quark is not nearly the adept businessman. You know, like, his mom is actually quite a bit better at it than
either of her sons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of the perfect thing to do. Think about how much more successful Quark would have been had his mom been able to openly, you know, teach him the ropes, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
And another very important moment where it's like, okay, Ishka says to Quark, like, yeah, you know, Rom could memorize the rules of acquisition, but you, Quark, could actually really understand them. And I think that's kind of an important thing about, like, where Quark is with his own culture versus where Rom is, and which I think is very indicative of where Rom eventually takes or will take Ferenginar on a road to reformation, too.
Yeah, and this episode also introduces Brunt, who becomes an important character as well.
Yeah.
From the Ferengi Commerce Authority.
The great Jeffrey Combs as well. So, and I also like the fact that Ishka is getting a rash because she starts wearing clothing.
Ishka is such a great character. And I do wonder how much better maybe this character's reputation would be within Trekdom if she had existed outside of these Ferengi episodes, which a lot of people just dismiss as goofy comedic episodes.
Do you think it's just fundamentally impossible just because she was stuck on Ferenginar? Like, she wasn't really allowed to travel because, you know, the Ferengi society sucks, you know?
Right, yeah, I think so, yeah. Because I would have liked to have seen what a character like this would have done, brought into just the general world of Deep Space Nine for the odd episode here and there.
Yeah.
Because her episodes do really are, they are stranded in these Ferenginar-based episodes.
This is also a very important one with regards to Ferengi culture, too, because we already have Nog. He's studying to become a Starfleet officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, Quark is making the argument like, okay, well, that's how it starts. One youth joins Starfleet, and all the other Ferengi want to start joining Starfleet. And honestly, I think it's kind of true.
I think so too. You know,
I think there's enough unsuccessful businessmen on Ferenginar. They're like, why is this kind of the society that we really want, where we're just punishing ourselves essentially? And you know, and I think it's true. You know,
what we see in, you know, our human world, it's like the 99% versus the 1%.
Sure.
What percent of Ferengis do you think are successful?
Well, it's all relative, you know, like, because it's tough to kind of, you know.
I wish the show had maybe tried to explain that a little bit. Like, have exploration of the different social classes,
like,
of Ferenginar.
Yeah, we never saw poverty-stricken, like, Ferengi. So
not really, no.
We saw a lot of, like, the ones that are on ships, you know, like, shooting people. Like,
how well off were they? If they were that well off, they aren't in ships shooting at the Enterprise.
And, like, Quark started off as, like, a cook on, like, a freighter.
Yeah.
You know? So how successful was he really after leaving that house?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I think that would be cause for more exploration if we can get into more of kind of Ferengi classes.
Yeah.
Okay.
One last thing about family business. I love when Quark visits the Tower of Commerce in this episode.
Oh, and
There's like the elevator that you have to pay Latinum to, and it's just like...
Even if he wants to sit down, he has to pay Latinum, and even if he wants to stand up, he has to pay Latinum too.
Like, I love the world building going on in this episode, and that, you know, this is the first time we visit the Ferengi planet, and I do love how it's comedic, but it's also believable from the point of view of this species.
You can understand why somebody would want to leave Ferenginar. And look, Quark doesn't have to pay Latinum to travel around on the turbo lifts on Deep Space Nine, you know? So it kind of says, okay, these are a space-faring species that see opportunities elsewhere. It makes sense that they would spread around the galaxy.
Do you think that they are the broadest alien species of recurring alien species on Star Trek?
Who would be their competition in this? I don't think they really have any competition, though.
I think you could make arguments maybe for early Klingons in TNG, where it's much more just warrior this, warrior that. But no, I don't think nothing compares to the types of things you're seeing, like at the Tower of Commerce and, you know, these rules of acquisition.
I'm just fearful that we're going to get, based on the Discovery Season 2 teaser, right, that we're going to get more sorry and sneezing in turbolifts, and that's going to be the broad recurring alien.
Would you say the Kazon, maybe?
Well, what do you mean by broad, though? When I think broad, I think kind of played for laughs.
Yeah, well, I guess when I think of the Kazon, I laugh because they're so goofy and ridiculous. But no, yeah, I can't think of another one really that fits the bill like the Ferengi do.
Yeah. I think another important episode would be Ferengi Love Songs. And this is marking Rom's engagement. And we also find out that Zek and Moogie, they're in a relationship now. And I think this is very significant because we actually find out that maybe Zek isn't like that, you know, horrible, horrible, you know, Grand Nagus that we all suspect. Do you think that his experience and profit motive trying to steal the profits maybe affected him in a certain way? Because people start saying, you know, like maybe Zek is kind of losing it.
Right.
You know, like maybe he's got a form of like Ferengi dementia. And it's actually Ishka who's like pulling all the strings. They kind of met the equivalent of like Ferengi internet, and he's attracted to her brains.
Well, they met in a Tongo tournament.
Okay. But he was attracted to her brains, you know?
Yeah.
And so I find this fascinating that, okay, she's the one who's actually kind of in charge of Ferengi Alliance at this point, or at least the economic decisions going on.
You know, it's interesting. We were talking earlier about Quark being drawn to these women who aren't submissive. Are any of these Ferengi characters?
Well, think about it. Like, his mom does not seem like that.
No.
So it's like, I think maybe is it a bit of a Oedipus complex to a certain degree?
And we see that Rom isn't either.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So
we don't have a Ferengi character who we see that really exhibited.
No. So I don't know. It's just one of those things like, well, society says I should think blah, blah, blah. But
and you touched on at the start of this episode, early on, where you talked about The Last Outpost, that they're interested in like the human female characters.
Yeah.
So I don't know. There's a whole lot to delve into, and I don't even know what to make of it, quite honestly. But no, like I really like the relationship of Zek and Ishka, because Zek is a character who I think is just walking that line to being really unlikable.
Yes. Yes.
Especially when he's like, you know, has like Brunt working for him and things like that. You're like, oh man, this guy's the worst. But no, I actually think this relationship does a lot to make Zek more, it gives him more dimension, because it does make us ask these questions. Like, really? Like, why is Zek drawn to this? Because Zek seems very, very old. And I think it's interesting that he is willing to change his worldview to a certain degree as well.
But
and we see that through Ishka.
That's part of his age and part of maybe his deteriorating mental state?
That's possible. But do you think Zek was ever like someone who was radical in his opinions?
I think he was somebody who had profit in mind, and that informed every decision that he made.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he gets to a certain point in his life, and he realizes money won't buy you love, Cam.
That is true. I want to touch on one moment in this episode that makes me laugh, random aside, but that's Brunt in the closet.
Yeah.
In the Moogie's house. That just made me laugh every time it happened.
Every time they opened up the closet door.
Yeah, and Brunt's just standing in there.
That was great.
I just love that.
Yeah. And the other great moment, though, is when we look at Quark's action figures and they have the energy whips like on the action figures. And I love how they're like really muscly action figures. Not at all like my Playmates Ferengi action figures that I possess. So,
and I like that this episode basically ends with Ishka becoming Zek's financial advisor.
Yeah.
because we are now seeing the change in the society is starting to happen. It happens actually very quickly within the context of a civilization. But
I also wonder how long it was coming in Ferengi society, where true. I just wonder how sustainable this society was, because as much as I hate an episode like, say, Prophet and Lace, they are establishing that, like, if we want to get more women involved in the economy, that's actually not a bad thing for men. It's actually doubling the size of the economy.
Right, yeah.
You see that in post-World War II, in which a lot of men came back from war, and women have been doing a lot of the same jobs, especially in, like, factories, and the economy had actually expanded, especially as more women went into the workforce in the 1950s and 60s. The economy expands. And right. So you actually have, like, the economic argument, and I think maybe if the Ferengi were having a tough time expanding in the Alpha Quadrant, as was established in the Negus, it only makes sense that you need to find other dimensions. And I think just maybe the economy couldn't really sustain, like, this misogyny that was that had been going on for thousands of years.
And I like that Ishka says to Zek, like, I won't lie, I believe in equal rights for females.
Yeah.
And Zek accepts her for this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of the few times where I really feel like the message of Star Trek is being conveyed through a Ferengi story in terms of, like, a higher purpose that's worth striving towards. A lot of the time, I think the Ferengi episodes are larks to a certain degree.
Yeah.
You know, yes, they might have a bit of a philosophical underpinning, but I feel like this is the first time where we're seeing, like, Roddenberry's vision reflected through these Ferengi stories, through this character of Ishka.
Before we jump to the end of Deep Space Nine, I'm wondering, are there any Ferengi episodes or Ferengi moments that you think are really important with regards to the evolution or the mythology of the Ferengi that we have not touched upon?
Because
I do think Dogs of War is an important episode.
Yes, definitely.
Here, but,
I don't think so. You know, you've got... I was going to mention Prophet and Lace just in regards to what you mentioned.
Sure. Did it have to be that one of the most important Ferengi mythology episodes also happened to be one of the worst episodes of Star Trek, period? Just one of the most offensive episodes, too? But one of my highlights from the Star Trek Las Vegas convention of 2017 was when Ira Stephen Baer was up on stage, the showrunner of Deep Space Nine, and he was taking videos of fan reactions to the series. He says, look, I want to hear criticisms of the show. So I got up on stage in front of a camera, Ira Stephen Baer just mere feet away from me, and I started just ragging on Prophet and Lace. And
right.
He was like, you know what? I do want to stage, like, a live reading of that one of these years. Like, we'll make it happen somehow. I'll try to explain myself. You know, I can't really, you know, try to justify this episode, but believe me, like, I'm working on it here.
Was that episode directed by Sitting Alpha Del?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. I remember seeing him on stage talk about that episode, and he said, like, the tone of the script versus what they were shooting were two completely different things.
Well, because I think Armin Shimerman and Sadegh Elfadel both felt as if it should have been a much darker...
That's what Sadegh Elfadel said he wanted, yeah.
You're talking about, like, a guy who pretty much almost kills his mother.
Right.
You know, and whereas that's... I think the writers are playing it for laughs.
And it has serious mythology building with the Ferengi as well, in an episode that is played as, like, you know, essentially Star Trek trying to do Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah. You say that...
Well, I know there's more complications in terms of the representation, but in terms of what I think the episode they're trying to market is, I think that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and the thing is, the reason that this episode just doesn't work nowadays, and the reason why it really didn't work at the time is because Quark, for those who forget, this is the episode where Quark literally gets a sex change.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it's depicted is it's just so offensive, and it's something that just, you know, would not ever come out of a writer's room nowadays. And it's not because, you know, everybody's just PC. It's just, it's such a heart-to-stomach sort of concept. So, Dogs of War.
Yeah.
That's where we actually have Grand Negus Zek announce to Quark, hey, you're going to be the new Grand Negus this time. You know, I was just joking in the Negus.
Yeah.
Now, totally real this time. Quark finds out, oh, wait, he mistook me for Rom. And the reason why is because Moogie, the puppet master here, recognizes that it's Rom who's really the one who can be attuned to the reformation that needs to take place in Ferengi society. And you and I joked, you know, a couple years ago on the podcast how there could be a fun spinoff where Rom ends up on kind of a Game of Thrones sort of show where it's like he's back in Ferenginar, and, you know, how many people are trying to kill him or do this
right,
or that.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if there's going to be enough people in Ferengi society that recognize that dramatic change needs to take place if they want, you know, the economy to work out here. I just wonder, and I think they should have touched upon them, maybe what the writer should have done is establish that the economy isn't so great right
sure,
now.
Sure, yeah, that the Ferenginar isn't in a great place.
Yeah, and I think if they can keep tying it back to kind of the rampant misogyny, and I do like the fact that they never sugarcoat the sexism that's in this society, and then they address it head on, and I think they were successful in doing something that was an element that was so problematic when it was brought up on TNG.
Well, it's funny. It almost feels like DS9 took it upon themselves to correct the sins that created by Roddenberry and Herbert Wright when they created the species in the first place. Like, they're trying to overturn all of the underpinnings of what that race was in the initial, you know, creation in The Last Outpost.
So what was it then about Deep Space Nine's depiction of the Ferengis that was so important? Why did the writers, besides the fact that you have, like, one character who is, you know, Ferengi,
mm-hmm.
why did that seem like such a richer mythology of a species than, say, the Bajorans, who, look, we've got Major Kira, we ended up with stuff like, you know, the prophets and the Coast of Mosion, but, like, I have to admit that the Ferengi mythology sticks in my brain much more than the Bajoran species mythology.
I think it's because I think the Ferengi are more interesting visually. They're more colorful. They're more interesting when you're just looking at an alien species on a show. And I think that is at least a lure for writers to want to fix them.
Yeah.
Because they know that these are characters that should work. And so I think that's maybe the initial lure. But I think it's also that the Ferengi culture is specific. It's very specific in what it is and how it operates,
right.
Which is something they can wrap their heads around. We've talked in the past about alien species, you know, that brought into the show where we couldn't even figure out what their philosophical drive was as a species. You're like, I don't really get it.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like the Ferengi, it's so specific and kind of odd that it would be very tempting for writers to be like, I can fix this.
But I still think that they want to figure out what the philosophical underpinnings are of the Gormagander.
You know, sure.
Watch out for space whales in Discovery Season 2. We're going to figure out what they're all about.
But also, they can relate to the Ferengi cause because all these writers grew up in a capitalist society.
Yeah.
And so the idea then is like, well, what are our problems on Earth and how could we reflect those in a Ferengi story and correct the problems that we're currently going through?
Yeah.
And I think that's a fun thing to do, especially in, you know, the writers of Star Trek are writing Star Trek episodes almost every day of their lives when they work on this show. The Ferengi episodes offer them an opportunity to do something different, which I think writers are often also very interested in doing.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Star Trek Voyager, we do get depictions of the Ferengis, notably.
Yeah.
It's the next sequel we're all waiting for, the follow-up to The Price, where we find out where the Ferengis that ended up in the Delta Quadrant on the other side of that wormhole, where they ended up and what they ended up doing. Cam, what was your reaction?
Yeah, this is False Prophets. I mentioned to you when we were doing the Ferengi research that there was one Ferengi episode that was so excruciating that I couldn't stop checking the timer to see how much time was left. It was this episode.
Yeah.
This is from Season 3 of Voyager, where, yeah, they stumble upon these Ferengi who have basically established themselves as gods on, like, this, you know, kind of primitive planet. It's actually a lot like the pitch that Roddenberry had for that two-parter, Ferengi's Gold. You can see that there are some parallels there. But ultimately, this is the worst type of Star Trek trying to do a Ferengi episode, where it's Neelix dressing himself up as a Ferengi, trying to go and con these two Ferengis out of their godhood and all this sort of stuff. But it just is, it's Star Trek trying to do comedy by way of just bumbling and mugging for the camera, which is just brutal to sit through because, you know, you watch an episode like Prophet and Lace, which is terrible, from Deep Space Nine, and you can just see how not to do a Ferengi episode. It was this really broad, lead-footed comedy, because Star Trek doesn't really have a light touch. And so when they try to do just full-blown, wacky comedy for an hour straight, it's tough.
Yeah.
And Voyager is all left feet trying to dance through this episode. And it's, I found, an absolutely brutal watch to sit through.
So the last time that we do really get to see a Ferengi-centric episode is on Enterprise with the episode Acquisition, and it's a bit of an all-star cast. We've got Ethan Phillips, Jeffrey Combs, and Clint Howard all coming back to play these iconic aliens.
And face down, Trip in his underwear.
That's an iconic alien right there. So, I'm trying to think about what this really adds to mythology, and that we know that they're out and about. We do know that the crew encountered them, but they really didn't know much about them.
The word Ferengi is never referenced.
Yeah, so fair enough. But they're so distinct looking. And are you telling me that there's no, like, I don't know, CCTV cameras on Voyager where they would have ever gotten a glimpse of these guys as they're robbing the ship?
I mean, that has the same problems as the Borg showing up in that regeneration episode where they're kind of proto-Borg, but it's, you know, it's the sort of thing someone might remember. I think the one maybe interesting thing about this episode is that they reference 173 rules of acquisition.
Yeah, I noted that as well.
Yeah, so they'd added, obviously, other rules by the time you get to the 24th century.
They got 200 years, so that makes sense.
Yeah, so I think that's interesting. I did note something, though. Brennan Braga, there was a lot of criticism for this episode introducing the Ferengi. And Brennan Braga said, "There's no excuse for the Ferengi. No excuse. That was an act of desperation. I hated it."
In season one.
In season one. An act of desperation in season one.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like TNG all over again.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah. I don't have as, I guess, ill a thought towards the episode as he does. Like, I think it was okay. It has some really creepy stuff with Jeffrey Combs' Ferengi and T'Pol.
Yes, and here's the issue, though. It's not just that the Ferengi are misogynistic, but the way that women are depicted, you know, from the script, though,
it's
horrible on the writer's part, because like all the stuff that the Deep Space Nine writers were self-aware of just went out the window with this script here. And look, Archer's describing T'Pol as like nagging, and she's always complaining,
right?
And it's like, okay, like T'Pol's supposed to be offended when she actually hears that, but what you're doing there is using like offensive stereotypes about, you know, the nagging wife on sitcoms, blah blah blah. And it's just like you're just perpetuating the same sort of like misogyny that's so rampant in today's society.
Yeah.
And like the script just has no self-awareness about that. And this is what made me really just like, oh god, guys, really?
It's tough to position the Ferengi ideals against Starfleet in a 23rd century show, because we've seen Picard and Riker and all those characters, you know, look at them and be like, this is not correct. So you're telling me 100 years in the past, like, what is the reaction of the crew of the Enterprise, the NX-01? It's going to be the same thing. Like, there's no development there. Yeah. There's nothing, there's no difference in the Ferengi approach in this in this era versus the TNG era.
I don't think this episode really adds much to the Ferengi mythology, though.
No.
So why don't we get into what maybe we can talk about Discovery, though? Because I think, like, you got to have the Ferengi in somehow. Like, I think
how do they work that in?
So I actually came up with what I think is the answer, though. It's not the Discovery crew that interacts with them. It's going to be the Klingons. Because I think it's pretty much guaranteed, like, Laurel is... I'd be shocked if Laurel's not in the main cast next season.
Yeah.
Same with Ash Tyler. So I think there's actually an opening for the Ferengi to be reimagined. But I don't know if we're going to get a Klingon-esque reimagining or more of an Andorian-esque reimagining. I would be shocked if they give it kind of the old Klingon treatment here, because you just really... Why are we really going to mess with their look that much?
No, I agree 100%. I think the Ferengi are something you have to keep fairly consistent. Klingons have gone through a lot of physical transitions over the course of Star Trek, whereas the Ferengi haven't. And so I think you kind of want to stay somewhat true to the template.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I would like to see them represented on Discovery, because not for the reason of, like, I'm just dying for more Ferengi stories, but more in the sense of, like, Discovery is such a unique beast within the Star Trek world for its tone and feel. And I would like to see how they tackle Ferengi behavior on a show that has that sort of tone.
And we also have...
It may go horribly wrong, but I would just be curious to see it.
But we also have, like... 30 years since the introduction of the Ferengi, where they can kind of rethink some of the more problematic elements and make it, like acknowledge those issues and try to reconcile them very much how they did on Deep Space Nine. At least we have kind of a roadmap of where the Ferengi will eventually end up, but it's going to be tough, because I don't see them interacting with the humans on Discovery.
You can't really. You could maybe have them meet, like, Saru, you know, by himself.
But he's still part of the Federation.
Yeah, still part of the Federation. Harry Mudd doing business with a Ferengi?
That might work. Yeah, that might work. Yeah. So, but then Harry Mudd is not going to be the specimen of humanity who's pushing back against all these issues. Harry Mudd's literally a sex trafficker.
Yeah. He's like, can I be a Ferengi too, guys?
Well, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. Look, I think they're going to bring them back just because... They're such an iconic species.
Yeah.
I just don't know if it's going to add much to the mythology. That's my concern.
Well, I don't see them being brought in as sort of a multi-episode story. But I could see them working them in for like a one episode, like sort of smaller appearance.
An acquisition?
Yes.
Like from Enterprise?
Yeah. 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 Like some, well, maybe not even as the driving force of an episode, but as.
Just pop
like,
in.
You know, we had like those Orions show up in the final episode the first season of Discovery.
Will you take my hand?
That's right. Now.
No, I was asking you.
Yeah. You can take my feet.
Okay. Yeah.
More foot massage.
More massage. Yeah. Massage-y. Yeah.
You know, I could see them working them in that sort of way, where they're an element of the story for that episode, but they aren't driving the story.
Yeah, and you know, that's fine, in that you're probably just avoiding a very problematic issue altogether if, you know, Laurel or Harry Mudd needs to get in touch with a traitor who only has this. They're in it for about a minute, and you get a good look at the Ferengi, and you go on your merry way.
I have a question for you. Are you interested in seeing the Ferengi, say, in the Picard spinoff, or a series set in that post-Nemesis era?
Yeah, I want to know what kind of reforms that Rom was able to put in place, because I think it'd do it a lot of damage to the character if he was unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. I think you and I are both skeptical of Rom's ability to enact these reforms, but he does have Ishka, like, let's be honest, Ishka's still kind of pulling the strings, even though she's retiring with Zek. I think Ishka's still going to help him out.
Right.
So I'd be bummed out if we don't see changes to the Ferengi.
Do you think we see any of those actors back as those characters?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
You know, I can, like, I'd be shocked if we don't see the return of every single one of the next gen crew, give them each, like, an episode. Sure. You know, but I think beyond that, you might have...
Argyle's waiting by the phone.
I want the Sonia Gomez reappearance as well. But I think beyond that, it might just get a little too fan servicey, and it's like, Patrick Stewart's like, hey, look, Jerry Ryan, I love seeing you at the conventions, but I just don't know how we actively pay homage to your character as well as, you know, treat the story correctly.
Right.
To me, it just gets a little weird.
And I guess, you know, we have kind of given Nog short shrift in this episode talking about the Ferengi.
Yeah.
And I would be actually very curious to know in a series going forward about what the Ferengi role in Starfleet is going forward. And, you know, I don't think they're going to bring Aaron Eisenberg back as Nog necessarily. But, you know, Nog is the first Ferengi in Starfleet. That's a big deal. And does this open the door to having more Ferengi?
Look, we saw in Future Imperfect, which was kind of a fake, you know, parallel timeline. No, it was like a holographic representation. But we did see that there was a Ferengi on the con, you know, in that episode. We know that Nog joined Starfleet. I would not be surprised if we get a shout out to one Captain Nog. You know, like you said, I don't necessarily believe he's going to be on screen, but if you have a character say, yeah, you know, Captain Nog recommended this. And if we see other Ferengi in the background as officers, I buy that. You know, it makes sense for where the species ends up, that more and more of them are appreciating Federation ideals as their own society reforms and goes from there. Do you think fans, though, Cam, will have an issue seeing a society that has gone through such a dramatic reformation versus where we first met them, you know, 30 years ago?
Eh, I don't really care.
I know you don't care.
But no, I mean, I don't know, because I think fans dislike early Ferengi stories so much that they won't care if you make those shifts. Like, okay, when you look at, say, what Discovery did to the Klingons, I 100% understand why people were angry about that, because the Klingons were very much beloved. You know, you go to a convention, there's a lot of people dressed as TNG-era Klingons. Whereas Ferengi, I feel like it's a lot more polarizing. It's a lot more, you know, some people love them, but a lot of people hate them. And so I don't think there would be the uproar over a shift in how they are portrayed or changing that society. I don't think people would necessarily care. And I think if you're introducing characters, you know, like Nog, who are Starfleet members, who are compelling characters into their own right, I think, you know, I referenced Damon Bok early on talking about TNG, how I thought it was really cool to have a character, a Ferengi character, who's not just alien race Ferengi. And I think having members of Starfleet who we spend time with who are Ferengi, who we get to know on a one-on-one basis, like we did, say, Quark, who's not obviously Starfleet, but we got to spend a lot of time with Quark, I think that does a lot of good for them, the same way that Worf did for TNG.
Right.
And so I think that would help a lot. Something that I would be really interested in knowing is, like, Nog was a character who seemed to shake the whole profit-driven aspect of Ferengi culture very quickly. And I'd be curious to know if there's like a generational effect where like these younger Ferengi aren't as driven by the motives of and sort of the beliefs of like a Zek, because Zek is very much like that crumbling old patriarch type of model. Do young Ferengi feel this way?
So then let me throw this back at you, and I alluded to this earlier, but do you think the fact that just exposure to the Federation fundamentally changes, you know, the Ferengi in that they're maybe such a pliable species that the fact that the three characters that we saw have the most exposure, the three Ferengi characters that we saw that had the most exposure to the Federation, they're the ones that were changed most and drawn in more to the Federation ideals, even though we know Quark was declaring at the end of Dogs of War that his bar will remain the last bastion of the real Ferenginar. You know, I think there's something very fundamental to the fact that we saw these changes being, I guess, characterized by these characters who had more exposure to the Federation than anyone else did in their society.
I think so. I do think Starfleet would change a lot of these Ferengi and maybe shift their way of thinking. I guess the question is just going forward, how much do future incarnations of Star Trek set further down the timeline open up Ferengi to having that exposure?
Look, I mean, if you can reboot the... Well, not reboot, but if you can bring on the Klingons in the 24th century and their allies all of a sudden, I think it's time for, you know... the Ferengi to be rethought to a certain degree. And they planted the seeds for that by the end of Deep Space Nine. And I think it totally makes sense.
It's interesting, too, when Brian Singer, who, you know, there's a problematic figure now, but, you know, when he was trying to come up with that Star Trek Federation TV series set in, like, the 30th century or whatever, the Ferengi were the ones who ruled the galaxy.
Right.
Which I thought was interesting in that, you know, he viewed very much the Ferengi as being potential power brokers in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it comes down more to execution, but I don't like the concept of that. And like, I understand where he's coming from, but I think what we want to know is that human ideals win out ultimately. And so it'd be kind of depressing that ultimately greed is the driving factor in the galaxy's ultimate disposition.
Not at all relatable to today.
No, I know, I know. But that's why I like Star Trek, is we should be striving for more.
Definitely. Well, we can only wait and see where the future takes the Ferengi, but I think, you know, their path has been very interesting so far. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll have videos up and all the usual stuff, so make sure to head over there. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, we are going to tackle an episode... It's called The Best of Voyager. I know you're thinking, well, didn't we just do the best episodes of Star Trek, period? Yes. And unfortunately, I don't think a single episode of Voyager made it into that.
I think I had one as like that was just outside of it.
Yeah, it's more like a notable, you know, like a honorable mention. So I think what we want to do is actually give the series the credit that's due, but we're going to be doing this in a fun format. It's not going to be like us just reading off like a boring list. You and I are going to have a bit of a debate.
What are you talking about? I already prepared an incredibly boring list to read off.
I apologize for misleading you, but we're going to have a big kind of cool debate, a bit of a battle going on. We're going to have to put forward our strongest contenders, and we're going to find out what is the best episode of Voyager. And this is going to be fascinating because, look, if you look at these like top 10 lists, you see a lot of the same TOS episodes, a lot of the same TNG episodes of Deep Space Nine. But if you look at people's Voyager lists, they're all over the place.
Yeah,
I've
definitely
never seen consistent lists for Star Trek Voyager. So we're going to have a deep dive into Voyager. It's going to be a fun one. And even if you're not a Voyager fan, I think this will be good for you to kind of jump off and figure out, hey, what are the episodes that I should be watching? So I'd really encourage everyone to listen to that one next week.
And I think it is always good for us to do a little more Voyager coverage, because it's a show that definitely I think we don't cover as much as some of the others.
I agree, and I have appreciated the fact that we've been able to do a lot of the two-parters recently, because Voyager does a lot of two-parters, and it's been actually fun for us to go in and think about these shows and just kind of analyze them and say what works and where are they, you know, facing some challenges. But I do genuinely like covering the Voyager stuff.
I can promise you False Prophets won't be on my list of the best.
Oh, that's well, maybe I'll make an argument for it on my list. We'll see.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Visions of a The Price Threequel Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R as in Rules of Acquisition, E-P-O-R-T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
transfer complete.